Welcome to Season 3, Episode 7 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Karen.
In this episode, we discuss what makes great app architecture.
When someone tells me this is the best architecture, it just honestly sounds to me like a five-year-old telling me why a stegosaurus is the best dinosaur.
We share your views how, apart from just coding, what is the number one skill a developer needs?
Having empathy for everybody else, as well as your users, is also, I think, very important.
Plus, so Michaela, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. It's Hacktoberfest is finally over.
Hooray!
So I am so excited because I literally would wake up to like 10, 12 GitHub notifications every single day for like actually 2 weeks. And that's just like wild to me.
It's 100% self-inflicted. I mean, it's in a good way, but it's just your fault, right?
It is all my fault. I did this to myself. But it was super, super fun, but it was also like very stressful. So I have to think of what will I do for next time. And I just actually, the day we are recording this, I just finished my recap stream. So it's like, this is what the project was. And looking at it, I counted the lines of code, like using a tool and script and everything. I reviewed about 2,000 lines of code was like added throughout the entire project.
Damn.
And I looked at over 100 PRs.
And I think this really just shows the world how much you love cars.
It does, because I don't even know where to go with that.
Well, next year, you've learned a valuable lesson, right? Next year, do something you actually care about, like snowboarding, for example.
We'll see. I don't know. I want to continue this project because it's a good project. And I was looking, being like a good indie developer and trying to really find like, if I could make money off of this app too. I was looking at like all the competitors and everything, and all the competitors I found for this kind of app, most of them are all cross-platform apps. Like you can actually clearly tell because they all use like Google design for a lot of the apps, and they have, and every single one of them has ads. So I'm thinking if I can just make an app that doesn't have ads and just paywalls like certain things, and it's good, like Apple UI UX design, I could probably make money off of it. So that's the next step. We'll see how that goes. First, I have to ship the app, actually. That is actual step one, is I need to ship the app to the App Store.
Yeah.
And then we'll see like if it can actually make money, but then also like because it's a pretty established project, I can use that and like continue it with like Hacktoberfest for next year, but we'll see.
And how does it work for those contributors? Do they going to get a little revenue share of your millions?
At the moment, no, because I think maintaining a project is dramatically more difficult than somebody contributing an important but also smaller piece of code for an issue that I've defined and laid out.
Right.
Because I have a lot of the issues, if you actually go through the repo, I have like spec'd them out and like wrote exactly what you need to do. So it's not like any abstract kind of thing of like, oh, hey, can you fix the delete? It doesn't work. It's more or like fix the delete because there's an error is not popping up when it should or something like that. I've written out like exactly, hey, in this file, put this here and like stuff like that. So it's more like very defined issues. And the whole goal of that was because there's beginners. So at the moment, my goal is not to have other contributors also make money off of it, because I feel like that's not fair if you add like one line of code that is not equivalent to me also maintaining an entire project that 55 people have contributed to.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think folks realize how hard it is to maintain open source projects. I get comments like to issues saying, is this fixed yet? Like, dude, it's an open source project. Just try it out. Or even better, you fix it.
Yeah.
I have other things to be doing. You know, I'm not focusing on this full time. It's not paid to do this work. It's quite a challenge sometimes. Let's put
it down. Yes, that is definitely true. Because yeah, I did not get paid for any of that. And I tried to track my time as much as I could, because I did find a GitHub action tool. You can like show the number of issues I've created and closed and the number of PRs that have been created and closed like throughout the whole project. So I still need to like go through and run this actual like tool and everything. But I want to run that and then also calculate the amount of hours I spent on this project. I actually probably spent like 100 hours on this project this past month. Not even joking. It was so much. Because I had 10 people contributed in the first 3 days. And what people don't think about when you hear those words is that That means I reviewed 10 PRs in 3 days, is what that actually means as a maintainer. So it was a lot of work. It was super fun, but it was also a lot of work.
I agree. It gives me hesitation, let's call it, about open sourcing new things. There's a project I worked on recently. My grandmother, who's 97, was very briefly ill. I thought, well, I better go and see her. So we get on a train to go up north. And it's a 4-hour train journey there and a 4-hour train journey back. So once you sort of subtract time for, you know, changing trains and getting drinks, whatever, I had about 6 hours of time on my hands to sit down, laptop, nothing else to do. Not going to do recording on a train in the middle of the UK. So I sat and made a new open source project, and it's brilliant and I love it. But I'm like, should I release this? Do I want to release it? Do I want to inflict this on myself to releasing all this stuff? I think it's a good idea. I haven't seen it done before. It's a project, and think for a second. It's a project to help people build their websites in Swift, which sounds like, oh, that's been done before, whatever. But I don't think it has been done before, because a lot of the projects I see basically just take HTML and put it in Swift. Mm-hmm. So if you can't write HTML, you can't really write Swift code either. You're saying, okay, now do a paragraph, now do a heading one, now do a div, now do whatever. Just HTML in Swift, which is neat. It's a nice idea.
Yeah.
My idea is more abstract. You say, listen, I want a carousel of pictures here. I want to have a slideshow here. I want to have a navigation bar here. And it fills in the HTML for you to make those things happen, more like SwiftUI does. You don't say, ooh, I want a scrolling thing with lines between and a scroll bar. You just say, give me a list, and you get a list out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so it works so well. You can make websites, really beautiful websites, that are adaptive and responsive for mobile and da-da-da in minutes, all in Swift. But I'm thinking, do I release it? It's only 6 hours of work. Do I polish it up and add documentation? Do I make a video about it? And then do I have to deal with all the issues, of course.
And that's the thing, too, that you just mentioned. You just started listing all the things you actually have to do as a maintainer to get the repo ready for other contributors. Because you can just like post it, make it public and say like, here, people have at it. But when there's no documentation and like no process for anything and like just no record of how anything works, then people can't contribute to it even if they wanted to. But it makes it that harder. But also, if you do want to make it an actual open source project where you are expecting people to contribute, you then have to make the repo ready so that it's easy for people to contribute to the project. And that is harder too. And especially because like mine was an iOS project, and then you have to deal with the like development team and signing and stuff like that. And like, that's a whole thing that just like as a mobile iOS dev that we have to do in our projects versus like, GitHub has this thing called like code spaces, and you can like, oh, develop like in the browser. Well, that's not possible for iOS dev and Swift. Like it makes no difference to have that feature, even though like it's really cool. It doesn't matter in the tech stack that we're in.
I see a lot of folks always saying, why can't Apple open source SwiftUI? And they could. They could just dump the source code on GitHub. But the cost of then maintaining that and handling, you know, SwiftUI evolution and reading code reviews, and because that gets baked into the OS, right? It gets baked into a billion phones. The opening for litigation and da-da-da is gigantic. And it open source is more challenging than you might think, folks. It's not easy at all.
Let's just talk about some Swift news that came out recently. So one of the first things is Swift packages is now on swift.org. So what does that really mean, though? If we just like read that headline, but what does that actually mean?
So for a long time, you know, swift.org was just a bit on the quiet side, let's say. It basically never updated. There's no fresh content on there. It was kind of dead. There was no real reason to go there. And it's a huge movement taking place to update and revamp that and rethink that to make it dynamic. So you can go there and think, actually, I want to go to swift.org today to find out what's new in Swift. And one of the ways that's happening is there's now a packages option in the sidebar listing new and upcoming packages for Swift. And you can go to the, say, for example, the community showcase section, and it lists a bunch of interesting packages happening right now that are doing cool things. And personally, I had argued that this should be on the homepage. You know, here's right now, here's what's cool and new in Swift right on the homepage, but it's at least on a sidebar, it's something. And I just love the fact that it's effectively the Swift homepage promoting the community. saying, check out this thing. It's really, really neat. And I'd love to see so much more of that.
Ooh, I love that. Because then, yeah, if you are somebody who builds a package that ends up being, and you are a maintainer, and then you end up building a package that a lot of people contribute to, you could then also be on like the swift.org homepage and, well, like in the sidebar and everything. And that's super exciting, because then like it really builds an actual community of you're building something that other people then use too, which is very rewarding, I think.
Yeah, I'd love to see it, like I said, on the homepage itself, that community showcase particularly. Because right now you press packages, then choose showcase, and then you see them. And if that was on the homepage, it'd be like, oh, it's like being featured in the App Store. Like my library is being featured on the Swift.org homepage right now. It would be a big thing. You'd feel really good about that. So I'm hoping this sees some initial acceptance and baby steps forward. We'll see where it goes. But I'm just glad there's something promoting more of the community. And ideally, this is the first of many steps. We'll start seeing things like, hey, here's upcoming conferences in the community, organizing meetups and stuff. Other languages like Python and PHP or whatever do it just fine.
Ooh, I like that. Because, yeah, I remember bookmarking a Twitter post like in January as somebody had made a huge thread of all the different upcoming like iOS dev conferences. And I think Codeco also released a blog post that was like that too. And it'd be nice to have it like in a single place so you could see every single like Swift conference. That would be super awesome.
I agree. And that should be, in my opinion, Swift.org. But we'll see how we go. It's a discussion, right?
We also had a scary fast Apple event that went on that was pretty scary. Ooh. And it was pretty fast as well. For anybody who didn't know, that the new MacBook Pro for the 14 and 16 inch, they both now have been upgraded to have the M3 Pro and the M3 Max chips in them now.
And apparently the M3 difference is just gigantic. The M3 Max beats the M2 Ultra in early benchmarks, which is quite remarkable. I've got an M1 Ultra in my Mac Studio, and it's a heck of a fast CPU, right? But if the M3 Max beats the M2 Ultra, and I'm already a version behind that, it's going to be scorchingly fast. But it's interesting, they announce all these new things, you know, the whole new GPU architecture, dynamic caching, yada, yada, yada stuff, right? But the thing I've seen most people talking about is that last words on the whole thing, this was shot on iPhone. They filmed the whole thing on iPhone, which is, I think, brilliant. But so many folks complaining because they saw behind it the rigs and the dollies and the lighting and saying, well, yeah, but apart from the multi-million pound setup, fine, it shot an iPhone. What were they expecting? They're not going to use the iPhone's flashlight, are they, to try and record Tim Cook for a multi-billion dollar announcement? That's not how life works.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was when the first Pro iPhone came out, like the Pro with the three lens, like telephoto lens, yeah, and everything. I'm a fan of Selena Gomez, and she had a song, Lose You to Love Me, that one and her one after that, oh my gosh, I can't remember right now, but both of those were shot on iPhone, like when that phone was first released. So that was like part of some deal that she signed, was like her whole music video was shot on like five different iPhones, actually all running at the same time too, which was pretty cool. But yeah, I know a little bit about lighting and cameras just because I do like YouTube and streaming and everything. And it's the lighting can make even a bad camera look good. Mm. So if you already have like a good camera, lighting just makes it better too.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm just glad that the actual event itself was quirky and funny in places, like, you know, the ghosty bat things going on. And they actually tried to make it quite lighthearted, and they embraced the Halloween thing a little bit, because it can be quite serious sometimes, Apple events. And so this one, they actually had some fun with it. So it was nice to see. And I've ordered my laptop. I've got an M3 Max coming shortly. Well, 3 weeks.
I have not ordered one yet. I am on the fence because I'm like, I spent so much money, which if you don't think about this, like, good for you. But these computers are so expensive. I was like, okay, I'm spending so much money. I'm going to buy a top of the line MacBook M1 Pro, like, or M1 Max when I got this. And I'm like, okay, we're buying it now. I'm not going to buy another computer for like the next decade was my original plan. But that may change. I really do like the Space Black though. We will see. Yeah. I haven't decided. I'm like, these are expensive. Like, to buy one of these machines, they're crazy. So it's like, you have I could buy a MacBook or I can get the Vision Pro. But we also don't know when the Vision Pro is coming out. So I'm like, okay, do I buy a MacBook? Do I wait? Do I buy a Vision Pro? But then when I do have a Vision Pro and I want to develop for it, then how is it going to work? Is the M1 Max going to be good enough? Most likely, it probably will be. But that is the internal debate I'm currently having, because these are expensive. And I'm like, do I really want to drop like $6,000? That's a lot of money.
But there's space black, Michaela. It's probably another one of those times you're like, oh, sorry, I was in diapers when that happened. But the last black book, the MacBook that came in black, was like 2007. Oh. It was a while ago, right? But it was beautiful. It was such a great MacBook at the time. And I'm so glad to see the black thing coming back again. So mine is definitely space black. Straight away, no question asked.
And the last thing that we have that scary event did not is Alexander Colucci every single year goes through and shows us through the Apple apps which ones use Swift UI and which use UIKit. And this year is the first time that UIKit only apps are actually declining as Swift UI is growing. So Swift UI is now at 21% of Apple's apps. And 1,500 of them are using Swift.
Yes, obviously Apple, you know, been using UIKit since day one. And so they've been growing for UIKit for 20 years now, how long it's been since they started UIKit. And this is it. This is the first year where Apple's own apps in iOS 17 are shrinking in number for UIKit only as Swift UI continues to grow, which I think it shows that the tide is slowly, slowly turning. There were, I think, of all the binaries, and there's lots of binaries with iOS, right? There's tons of tiny little binaries doing, you know, wallet stuff, for example, a little binary here and there. And they have 385 now using Swift UI, which is up from obviously only a handful. I think it was 4 in iOS 13. So it's growing dramatically, Swift UI use inside Apple, which means, of course, Swift is as well, because you don't get Objective-C UI sadly at this point. And so it's just growing and growing and growing. And in fact, last year, Apple did say upfront, Swift can now be used for the really very serious stuff. The Secure Enclave, for example, was previously Objective-C only, and the Swift wasn't recommended for that, but now it is. They're like, yeah, you go on and use that too. So the tide is turning, I think, at Apple. And Apple, of course, for a long time, have been the number one user of Objective-C for basically ever. And now that's slowly, slowly changing. So it's good to see.
I wonder what will be the tipping point, as in, like, so they're using it now more in like 20% of the apps. Like, what will make it so that it's like 50%? Like, are they waiting for some feature that they're planning on shipping? Like, is the turning point now because they like did the navigation stack rather than navigation view, and that just like helped all of them? Like, what is the feature?
I think it's more that they are a company like everyone else, not going to throw away old code and rewrite it from scratch just to use Swift UI. They'll just do new things with it from scratch. You know, all new apps, they might say, listen, just use Swift UI if you can, and certainly use Swift, don't use Objective-C. So it's just a matter of time. It's just like a war of attrition, basically. Very slowly, it'll just fade away until eventually, phew, no more.
Until we have the iPhone 100.
Hopefully before then. Our theme this episode is, it sounds so simple, but not at all, what makes great app architecture? And that probably already has a few folks mentally screaming their answer through the podcast listening app, whatever that happens to be, because it can be a fairly strongly opinionated thing, let's call it that. People have very firm ideas on what makes great app architecture. Let's just get into it here. What do you think, Michaela?
Before we even get into that, let's break down what is app architecture? When somebody says that, what do they actually mean? What are we talking about?
Are you answering a question with a question?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Like a true podcaster.
I think the problem is, but when you start saying things like architecture, particularly at conference talks, it can really spiral out of control very quickly. People want to go on stage and show that they are forward-thinking and thought leaders or whatever with some brand new architecture. And they can't just say, this is the way I write my code. They want to have something grandiose. It's an architecture. And it just sounds like they're better and bigger than you. And it's an odd thing. And you certainly see these people who we call architecture astronauts. who can get lost in building increasing like huge Lego superstructures of code to try and accomplish something. And then you realize, wow, so how does Uber or Facebook have like thousands of iOS engineers? How do they possibly all have jobs? Oh, I see now. I see now. One of the world's most complicated architectures being used here. Wow. And that's me, in fact, not answering your question at all. So good luck with your answering yourself.
Man, that was a power move of, I didn't answer your question with a question, but I said a lot of words.
I'm bouncing it back to you. Answer your own question, damn it, you lazy bum. Get to work.
I would guess when I think of app architecture, I like to think of just how is the code organized? Because we're all writing like Swift, iOS code, showing stuff on the screen. But it's where do we put certain pieces of functionality is like how I like to break down what is app architecture. So where is your networking code?
Right. I'm going to stop you right there. Folks, just rewind a minute and listen again to her answer. That's a brilliant way to start this kind of interview question. Where do you put your code? Where do you put the responsibility? How do you structure things at the basic level? If you start answering things like, oh, MVVM, MVC, Viper, I don't know what you're going to answer with, you've kind of lost them already. Just get to that core of how do you actually position your code? Where does it go? Sorry, interrupt. You carry on.
And once you find out where you want to put the code, you have to give it a fancy name.
Oh, obviously. That's important. Are you into Guy Rambo's site? Is it iosarchitecture.top? Is that the one?
I think so. Yeah.
Just Google it real fast. So I went to View Singleton Router, VSR, iosarchitecture.top, absolute classic. Yeah, SFMVP, Store Functional Model View Presenter. It just makes new ones randomly. It's absolutely brilliant. And it just encapsulates the idea of giving it a fancy name right there.
I believe it was Mark Moikins has a pattern that's like MVVM. He called it Voodoo for like view, observable object, and like data object, I think.
Okay.
I'd have to double check. But yeah, it's kind of breaking it down. It's just where do we put everything? Like, and we're talking about code as in like the responsibilities for what does what. What is the networking side? Stuff that talks to third-party APIs. Where does that go? What is stuff that talks to your local data storage? Which things talk to your cloud database? Mm. That kind of thing.
And ultimately, something has to do that. You see folks say, oh, yeah, in SwiftUI, I've really cracked it. I've really nailed it. This is the best architecture. It's model view, MV. And that's the thing. I'm like, okay, cool. So how do you do networking? Is that in the model? Is it in the view? Doing networking in the view? How do you test that? And it's not easy. And I think that's, honestly, it's not an it depends answer. It's a not easy answer. When someone tells me this is the solution, this is the answer, this is the best architecture, it just honestly sounds to me like a five-year-old telling me why a stegosaurus is the best dinosaur. It's like, cool story, bro. You've nailed it. You figured it out. Yeah, cool. You do you. And then you walk away because there is no best. You know, it definitely isn't the case that I have a fixed architecture in every project. Now, I reuse lots of code. I've got libraries of code I can think, oh, I've done this before, pull it in very quickly. But I don't reuse architectural choices. I don't say, oh, yes, MVVM is the one true way to use SwiftUI. I must copy that exact thing and force it into a new app. And that's caused so many problems over the years. You know, I remember folks in the early days of SwiftUI were saying, Paul, how do I do coordinators in SwiftUI? Because they worked brilliantly. MVVMC or MVC with coordinates, whatever, was great in UIKit. It solved lots of problems in UIKit, but doesn't mean it works great in SwiftUI. And you know, one of the biggest problems I've seen is when people take ideas from elsewhere, like the Gang of Four book, Design Patterns, the classic Design Patterns book, which has 23 design patterns that we talk about and reuse and think about. And they were great when they were designed for Smalltalk, which is what they were designed for, or Java or C++. But you shouldn't just take them wholesale and say, yeah, this needs to be used in Swift somehow, because maybe it can be a bit of a clumsy fit in Swift.
Yeah, I faced this too when I just, with my Hacktoberfest project on using SwiftUI with Swift data, that we were trying to use MVVM and put the actual query for getting the data in the view model part of it. but that really did not work out.
Nope, not even fractionally.
So I posted about it. I was like, hey, so I found this article by this guy named Paul Hudson, and he has it on his website called Hacking with Swift. And it says how to use Swift data with MVVM. And it doesn't get you all the way there. But then when I posted about it, it had a lot of comments on, yeah, basically don't do it, is what everybody said too.
Yeah. And I think I might edit the article to say that. I'm not dismissive of it. I say this is difficult to do. Mm-hmm. But the subtext is just don't do this. Swift data, the way it's written, fights against MVVM very strongly, which is a shame because I want to write tests to my code. I rely on tests to prove my code works well. And I just can't. I have to use core data. And that is a frustration right now. I know it's something they'll probably look at and fix for 18 next year, but it's frustrating in the meantime, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There are, though, a handful of design patterns, which I think are important. And that's, you know, another fancy word for architecture, design patterns, realistically, because, you know, reusing code matters, but reusing ideas also matters. And it means when you're in like a Scrum or some other email discussion or whatever you're working with, and someone says, hey, we should use the template method here. That's a well-defined design pattern already. And it means you can kind of bypass explaining what this thing is, if everyone knows what it is, of course. You can bypass that and have a little short circuit. Everyone gets the idea fairly quickly and can start thinking about it, how it fits to the current project, rather than starting from scratch every time. And I think those ideas are more reusable because you aren't trying to squeeze in this exact pattern. You can say, how about this or how about that? And find the one of the four that actually does fit your project.
So that goes into, I think, the what makes great app architecture is finding the right architecture for that situation.
It depends.
Is what I'm getting out of that.
I certainly believe very strongly in the Kent Dodds famous phrase, make it work, make it right, make it fast. And you know, my initial architecture, let's call it that, for any new project is absolutely hideous. It's on fire, you know, breaks the Geneva Convention kind of level of horrors. And I just throwing ideas out there quickly. I want to build something as a proof of concept very quickly. And then I'm thinking, well, okay, I'm now building the 10th screen or the 10th thing with this architecture. Oh, look, it's kind of clunky here, here, and here. Can I refactor it to do this? And then I refine it over time just by using it. It's like weathering in geography. You know, you have this big sort of sharp, spiky mountain, and it rains and smooths and smooths and smooths and smooths it down to a nice, ultimately green Everglade kind of thing. And years ago, I actually met D. Richard Hipp, the creator of SQLite, who told me, by the way, it's a fun fact for listeners, that SQLite he pronounces as a mineral. He pronounces it as SQLite.
What?
Like, you know, carbonite or similar. I know. And he's a creator, so there you go. Anyway, he says, when someone contributes to SQLite, he says, have you already refactored it several times? That's his test for, is it now commit-worthy? Have you rethought it and refactored it multiple times before he accepts it? Because he doesn't want your first pass. He wants your 10th pass after you've tried various combinations of ideas. And I like that idea. You know, weather it down, smooth it down with rainfall and use case, basically. And eventually it says, yeah, this is the best I can make it. Boom. That's your architecture.
Yeah, that's how I think about when I'm coding at work at the moment. I work on client projects. And before, like, I put up any code for a PR, I look at it as if I'm the person reviewing the PR. Ooh, so it's like, what would I point out to somebody that's like, hey, why'd you write it this way? So it's kind of like you get that third person view of like, not you're the creator of this anymore, but it's like, what would you say to somebody reviewing this thing now too?
That's hard to do because I think generally we review other people's PRs much more strictly than our own code. We're like, oh, it's my code. It's fine. In it goes, you know, git push, force, whatever. It's fine. But their code, oh, you're tabbing here and spacing this variable name.
Ooh. Yeah, for sure.
You know, Michaela, you do a fair amount of client work. And obviously, I don't want to ask you specifics about the clients you work with and for, but you must see a wide range of code, a range of approaches and architectures and design patterns, whatever you want to call it. And are there a handful you think, okay, I can say this one here, this sort of particular idea tends to resolve in a bad direction. Tends to end up with a more confused code or more inefficient code or harder to work with.
Yeah, I've found so far I've liked all the architectures that I've used on different projects, but also I've used different ones here and there too. So I've used MVC for projects, MVVM, Model View View Model, Model View Controller, for people who didn't know, all of those lovely acronyms. And I've used TCA, so the Composable Architecture. And we have one at Lookability as well called ViewStore, which is based off of TCA. So it's even like a modified version of TCA. But it's kind of just figuring out like, how does the architecture itself work? And then kind of going into how do you actually use it the correct way too? So you don't want to come into a code base and like kind of rewrite parts of it or write them. And you can clearly tell like this newly added code doesn't follow what's already in the code base. That's like not a good thing, but also it's not a good thing for like the project as a whole, but also like as a developer, because then like you're not kind of coding it correctly if you're just like throwing something together and be like, hey, here's this, it functions the right way, but like 10 years down the line or even like 6 months down the line, somebody has to go edit that and then they're like, what is going on? Why is this one feature like dramatically different than the whole code base? So I've seen like good ones, and I've found like the best way to kind of do that is like follow the conventions that's already in the code base and like how the code is written. So you like you have to read it properly and like know what's going on, and then write it in the way that like it all seems like it's the same code base rather than like five different code bases together. But I haven't found something specific for what always works a certain way. It's more of I've been using a lot of SwiftUI at work too, so it's kind of just like. So it's like for us, it was really depending on the project and when I worked on these projects. It was SwiftUI was kind of different for every single time because SwiftUI has been changing too.
Yeah.
So like what was good with Navigation View is now kind of different with now Navigation Stack. So it's been interesting. I don't have an answer then to your question. It's more of for a client work specifically when you're joining an existing code base, which works for like as a client or really when you're joining any kind of job and you're working on a code base, follow what's already in the code base. Hmm. Like don't dramatically change it unless you and others are in the middle of some big refactor and that's the point. But if you're just like adding features, don't dramatically change what the architecture is or make it, I don't know, weird. Look like you were the one who wrote this versus like everybody else.
Yeah, I think if you're writing code, just like MVVM and Swift Data, if you're writing code that feels like you're fighting against the way the project's built, you know it's going wrong. And you know, I can feel it in my own code. I'm writing something in here, it takes work to build something new, then it's going sour. You know, when your pieces just fit together, like click, 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 you've got a new thing done very nicely, then you know, yeah, this really, really nails it. And also, I definitely have a better sense now. Now that I'm very old now, now that I'm older and more mature, I've got a better sense now of when I'm screwing over future Paul. And actually, a few times in my career, I've had these like apocalypse moments where like, oh, damn, that's completely changed the way I think about work. And one of them was talking to Suresh Kanlu. We were sitting and having, I think, lunch or something in a park in San Jose. And he was telling me about a project he wrote ages ago for WWDC about making people meet up at WWDC parties and stuff. I forget what it's called. Anyway. And we were just talking about dates, how you store, not you know dates of a dinner, but like, you know, storing dates, how you store dates. And he said, I just store it as a Unix timestamp. You know, an integer is my entire date. And I'm like, oh, so you don't use, you know, the date object or similar. No, I just store an integer and figure out from there. I'm like, whoa, that must cause all sorts of time zone problems. And he's like, no, I just do it properly. And that it sounds simple, but in my head, in the past, when I've stored timestamps, I've done so as basically a shortcut to being lazy. Just put the integer in there, figure out later on, and screw the time zone. And it led me to realize that ultimately it's just a number, right? You know, Foundation's own date type is a simple float behind the scenes. But you have to, when you recognize, okay, I'm doing this as a little short circuit, that is going to cause you problems in the future. And so now when I'm working on projects, I'm much more careful of not cutting corners, because it absolutely will, always has come back to bite me in the backside. And when I spend the time to make good, polished code, it's fantastic and it pays off for years to come.
Yeah, and that is a new term that we haven't cited yet, which is called a code smell for anybody. So it's like, you think something weird is happening? It probably is. It's a smelly spell. That smells smelly. So our open ballot this episode is, apart from coding, what is the number one skill a developer needs? We had some good opinions about this one. I really like this one because it's kind of just getting away from developing. And let's just talk about everything else that's involved in actually being functional at a job. And so let's kick it off with Joseph Heck says, I'd argue more important than any programming skill is communication. If you can't share and impart information effectively and clearly, you'll struggle with everything else.
This honestly it's the easiest answer, I think, the most obvious answer, but also one of the hardest answers, because I think there's a bit of a stereotype about developers that we are introverted, we kind of talk in monosyllabic sentences, we keep things to ourselves. And firstly, that's not true. I think there are many wonderful communicating developers out there, but it is very important. And if you were to think to yourself, if you were to hire someone for your team who's like a 9 out of 10 for coding skill, but a 3 out of 10 for communication, would you prefer them? Or would you prefer a sort of 7 out of 10 coding who's also 7 out of 10 communicating? And it isn't just about doing more and more code. If you can't listen to people carefully, understand what they mean, ask clarifying questions, and then deliver the results back to them clearly and effectively, is it worth doing the work in the first place? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, because that would go into how one person can do their job of complete a specific task, but when they need help doing that task, or they need to talk to somebody else about that task, now you're getting into communication. And somebody has to be good at communication for you to then lead into what Shane Mack says, which is working together as a team, because most jobs, ventures, etc., are not made by a single person. So you have to have the ability to collaborate with other people too. And that, I think, is probably one of the most important things with communication, is if you can talk to one person, but also you have to talk to your whole team too, because generally some team that you're on is not just going to be you in one other person as well.
Yeah, and I think it sounds silly because we spend such a long time trying to teach small children this lesson. You know, how do you play nicely together? Right? We spend a lot of time teaching small kids, but I think some adults could use the lessons too, because it is actually surprisingly hard. And learning to ask questions and share ideas and criticize ideas rather than people, for example, is definitely undervalued. And it's interesting with 100 days stuff. I tell folks, you know, please, please, please. My golden rules are watch out for shiny object syndrome, where you get distracted by some other thing happening over here, you know, side projects, whatever. And please don't lone wolf it. Don't say, I'll do it by myself, asking no questions, talking to no one, da da da. And people go to all sorts of lengths to avoid having to ask questions and to talk to other people. They'd rather talk to ChatGPT and get incorrect answers from there than to say, hey, by the way, you with 10, 20 years of experience here, what does a set do that an array doesn't do, whatever you want to try and clarify, and get an actual human, clear response. And I don't know why.
Yeah, that's how I built my whole social media presence, was posting about what I was learning. And when you post about something, it's funny too, if you post about something and it is incorrect, the fastest way to get answers is because it's incorrect. People will want to correct you. But also, even further than that, in a more good intentions thing, people will want to show you what the right answer is, or a better solution to help you as well. Not everybody has malicious intent on something, but they just also want you to know, hey, this is the best way to do something. And that's a better way than some other way that you may have been thinking.
I just saw today, and there's a couple of good sort of lighthearted trolls right now on the internet. And one of them is from, the thing is, talk about the new Apple MacBook Pro, da da da, starting with 8 gigabytes of RAM and 5 gigabytes of storage. And she replies saying, that's the point, guys. iCloud is a thing. I always go for the lowest and cheapest RAM option. and then just use my 2 terabytes of iCloud for swap. And there's so many people trying to respond to her saying, that's not how RAM works. That's not what's for. And she knows. She's just having a joke. And because it's the internet, you can't really tell sometimes. And particularly because it's a she doing it. People want to jump in and mansplain to her that she's wrong. And so, that's, I find that kind of thing quite funny, actually. I'm quite childish in that respect.
That almost goes with what Noam Efragan also says is one of the best, most important skills a developer needs other than coding is pretending to code when your manager walks by.
This is so important. Isn't, again, we keep on citing XKCD, but there's an XKCD cartoon. I think it's called Compiler.
Oh, yeah.
You know the one straight away, right? And there's sort of like this two developers on chairs sword fighting, and manager goes, "What are you doing?" And they say, "Oh, the code's compiling because it can take a long time for your code to compile sometimes." And so obviously, get one of the fancy M3 Maxes, you won't do that anymore. But it's a good excuse anyway.
That's funny. At Lookability, we actually have a product that it's an app called Build Watch.
You do?
Yeah, you can see how long you've been waiting for Xcode to compile.
I was recommending that to someone just recently because they weren't sure where their time was going. Like, you would get this thing. I think there's an Xcode setting that basically exposes the build results. Mm-hmm. I think your app takes that and charts it nicely. What I want to see really is that just boiled down to enter your salary here and we'll watch time to tell you how much literally money is being burned while you wait for your code to compile. And that produces an advert for buying a new MacBook Pro with the M3 Max because you could save so much money on balance.
I think, I can't remember which company, but I'm pretty sure one company did do that as like a blog post. They were like, this is why it's literally more fiscally responsible to buy M1 Maxes at the time was because if you calculate the engineer's salary on how long they're just sitting there waiting for Xcode to build, it makes more sense to spend the money to make a machine that compiles faster, which it's like funny and wild to think about it like in that way. But I mean, that's actually how it all works though, too.
Oh, it and obviously that was the biggest jump, right? From Intel to Apple Silicon. I still have an Intel i9 laptop, 16-inch, last one they made. And it's used by one of my kids today. And it feels so sluggish. And it's a clean install of macOS. There's no cruft on there. It's macOS and Xcode, nothing else. And it just feels terribly slow compared to Apple Silicon. I can see that job particularly was a good reason. I might build the app. Just like, why you should buy me a MacBook Pro app, basically.
Yeah, Ian Patterson mentions delivery. What matters most is users can use and clients can do clienty things. An undelivered app is worthless. A shockingly coded app that works might be priceless. Delivery first, perfect second. Which that is the essence of what I'm trying to do with this Hacktoberfest project is cut out everything I don't need and just deliver. Like ship this app because if it never goes on the App Store, it's sad. Like my last Hacktoberfest project was, I was like, oh, I'll post this after Hacktoberfest, post the updates. I never did that. And then Twitter killed the API. And then now the app never existed with all of everybody's Hacktoberfest changes. So this year, yes, I need to just ship it.
I think we do place a lot of emphasis on perfection. And I understand it because, you know, the computers are pretty unforgiving, right? There's a saying that they're like Old Testament gods. they're quite vicious things, and particularly compilers. You make a small mistake and that's it. Your code won't even run anymore. It's going to bail out straight away. When actually, we're trying to solve problems. And if you've solved a problem brilliantly with, again, terrible code, horrifying code, you just don't care. I mean, your app can be held together by bits of string and tin cans, but it solves their problem. They're happy.
Yep, that is like the... Is it an XKCD comment or...
Probably is, yeah. Whatever you're going to say, probably
cartoon, is. Cartoon, or it's the, like, all the blocks that are held up for, like, this is the architecture, this is the code base, and it's the one little block of your really crappy code that's holding it all up.
Yeah, I think it's like this one guy in Nebraska or something holding up the entire thing. Yeah, I know exactly.
Moving on to Mark Aupont says, learning how to learn is the most important because to be a developer is constantly learning new things with new APIs and new problems that we're solving. Mm. That also leads into what Sven Schmidt says, which is not a skill per se, but a trait that's helpful to develop is curiosity. Our industry is constantly changing as compared to others, and to be curious about different things helps you stay abreast above those changes, or if only just to identify the fads that we have.
I call this the Apple treadmill. It's not an Apple specific thing. You'll get Microsoft and other platforms do the same thing. I'm sure Google and similar. There's a lot. You are constantly learning new things and new APIs, as Mark said. And I know when I'm ready to retire from this industry, when I'm bored of that. I think it'll be a long time yet. I hope it'll be a long time yet. Because I love it. You know, every year, new iOS, macOS, tvOS, watchOS, now visionOS come out, plus point releases along the way. We have new Swift versions with huge new features, new devices every year. Things are happening all the time. And you've got to keep on top of it. You know, that thing you learned 4 or 5 years ago might be good for a while, but it keeps on changing. And users want the new things. They want things like widgets for your app. And you've got to keep learning and enjoy it too. Get used to the idea of learning. And it's like, I told you before, I think, that on the podcast, that one of my favorite interview responses is just being honest, saying, no, I don't know that thing you're asking me about, but I'd love to learn. Show that you are curious and you're keen to move and keep abreast of things that's changing. It doesn't actually matter very much.
Yeah, I think that's, what is it? One of those quotes that you've read somewhere is like, the only constant is change. And that is especially true within like the tech field. If you look at like the iPhone, that only came out like 10 years ago. Or wait, was it 10 years ago? Was it 15?
You see how old you are now, Michaela? It wasn't 10 years ago. It was more than that, Michaela.
What was 10 years ago? What's 2023? It's 2013. Okay. Math is hard.
Math is
15
hard.
Years ago. It was the 15th anniversary, right? That's what it was.
We're on iPhone 15 now. Let's stick with that, shall we?
That's a good way. Forgot about that. It didn't really come out that long ago. And in that entire time, it has changed dramatically. And then now we're in the very first Vision Pro. How is that going to change in the first 3 years? Because SwiftUI has changed so much in the first 3 years. You almost can't watch tutorials from when it first came out to now because they're so different and the syntax has dramatically been different.
Oh, huge difference. I was looking at some SwiftUI code recently and it was SwiftUI 1 code. And even things like, you probably remember this, because a while ago now, you had to write self dot, self dot, self dot everywhere in structs, because it was a closure, like a button action, have self dot whatever inside it to do stuff. And they realized, well, you can't capture self because it's a struct. So why do we have self dot? So they improved the compiler to remove that early on. But it was worlds apart different between where it is now. There was no state object. There was no observable, you know, the very, very new stuff. It's changed a lot. And it's interesting, you know, I'm preparing right now. This is a bit further away, perhaps, folks want a sneak preview. I'm preparing a mini course on Hacking with Swift Plus about learning UIKit for folks who've just got a Swift UI career so far. I've done like 2 years of Swift UI, but they want to get a job in UIKit. How can they transition their skills across to UIKit? And a large part of the course is, by the way, you're going to meet a huge range of UIKit. You're going to meet, you know, folks using UI table view, self row index path, which these days is discouraged in place of the new content configuration stuff, but you're going to meet it. And you got to get used to that and meet this old ways of doing it, because that's just how things are written for a very, very long time. And so it's not as simple as just learn the newest, greatest way of doing it, which is what happens with UI. You've got to learn all the old stuff too. So it's a much bigger ask these days.
Ooh, yeah. I started a YouTube series that was like that, and I got through 2 videos, and then I stopped.
Classic Michaela.
It's a lot. And Susanna Gupta has a really good point that I don't think we've talked about yet within all of this, is not only communication is important, but really empathy is important. Being able to feel your users' pain points with the tasks your software is hopefully helps them complete. And being able to understand your teammates exists beyond their work themselves too. Being kind and understanding with yourself as well. Because it's easy to get caught up in like, I'm solving a really hard problem right now. Like, I can't talk to anybody, or like, you're in a really bad mood because you've been solving that one problem for like ever and it still doesn't work. But having empathy for everybody else as well as your users is also, I think, very important.
Yeah. I mean, just if you can do nothing else, at least try and think that everyone has bad days. Everyone has off days when they're didn't sleep well, they've hurt themselves somehow, they've had problems at home, whatever it is, and they're not going to be on their A game today. They're not going to be particularly happy with random questions. They respond grumpily, whatever, they're short-tempered maybe, I don't know. Like right now, just like last week, so last we're recording, this is Friday, folks. Like just less than 7 days ago, I twisted my ankle.
Oh, no.
Really badly. I had a bad twist. It's still today extremely painful. I missed a step walking down the stairs because it was dark and twisted it, landing on the wrong step. It really hurts. Anyway, and so you might get a whole range of very short-tempered answers from me right now because I am actually in pain most of the day. And so my poor kids have to live with me right now. If they screw up, I'm not going to be in the best position to answer them and help them out because I'm genuinely in pain. And it matters. It's a small thing, but, you know, maybe they didn't sleep well because the kids are up at night or whatever. Having empathy and thinking where they're coming from is damn hard, but it's really at the core of what we're doing. So please practice.
Yeah, that's something to always remember with everybody in every situation, because you never know what somebody else is going through just because they don't say it. Like, we're talking about answers from social media. You see only one side of social media. You don't see other sides that people don't decide to post about. And to wrap it up with a very good point, too, is Chris with Stanley says, empathy for Xcode, because it's trying its best out there.
And that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Our next open ballot is going to be, how do you approach debugging? Particular techniques you use that work well for you? Let us know when we ask on Twitter, Mastodon, and more in a few weeks. As always, please leave a review if you love the podcast and tell your friends to subscribe. Until next time, folks, take care.
See ya. I hope somebody gets my SpongeBob reference.